Hello, this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin. Last week we began a series of programmes looking ahead to Hay Festival, one of the biggest and best literary events in the world. It's taken place annually since 1987, and this year it will be online from the 26th of May to the 6th of June, broadcasting the world's greatest writers and thinkers for free from Hay-on-Wye, the small town on the border of Wales. And Monocle Reads and Meet the Writers will be there, bringing you highlights from the festival and interviews with the participants. Well, this week I want to tell you a little about Hay on Earth. This is a series of 22 events counting down to COP26. Speakers will be discussing the latest environmental science, sustainable policies and creative responses to the climate crisis. One of those speakers is Jonathan Drury. He's an author, a scientist and an executive TV producer. His previous book was Around the World in 80 Trees, and he has a new one out now called Around the World in 80 Plants. Jonathan, how are plants adapting to climate change?
Well, some of them are adapting okay because they can essentially move uphill and find somewhere that's cooler or drier or wetter, depending what they need. The plants that are really not doing well are the ones in flat areas, particularly around arid lands, because they have to migrate an awful long way to find a climate that's any different from where they are now. So, you know, plants are just not able to adapt fast enough. And 40% of our 400,000 or so plant species are actually under threat at the moment.
And how can we stop that?
Well, the big things that we can do are eat more vegetarian food. So wherever you are on the continuum between, you know, eating red meat every meal and being a complete vegan at the other end, move towards the vegan end. So the reason for that is that more than three quarters of all the soy that we grow, all the maize that we grow, is fed to animals, and that's incredibly inefficient. So that land could otherwise be used either to retain forest and conserve forest, or it could be used for supporting many, many more people if they're vegetarian.
Mm. Your book tells wonderful stories about, well, 80 plants, obviously, talking to the title. And I wondered if we could delve into some of them. For instance, tell us about the mandrake.
Well, the mandrake is not just something out of Harry Potter. It's a real plant, particularly around the sort of southern Mediterranean, Italy and so on. And for centuries, since Roman times, it was the plant that was used as an anaesthetic, often mixed with wine. And you can imagine how incredibly valuable that would have been. And I think that there was a rumour put around, really, by people who had land where mandrakes were growing, that, you know, with all sorts of sort of occult and witchcraft associations, so that people thought that, you know, the scream of the mandrake would kill you if you pulled it out of the ground at night. So they used to sort of attach a dog by its collar to it and then scare the dog away to pull it out. And, you know, the mandrake root looked like a person, especially with a little bit of judicious whittling, I think. And so, you know, all of these things put together, combined with the fact that it had these very powerful analgesic and actually sort of hallucinogenic drugs in them, combined to associate it with witchcraft but also make it very valuable.
Now, speaking of drugs, the contraceptive pill is originally plant-based.
Yes, yeah, the first contraceptive pills were made out of diosgenin, which was the precursor chemical for progesterone, in Mexico. And the Mexican yam, you know, you're probably familiar with yams, but these fantastic tubers that grow underground are the plant's store of nutrients from season to season. Contain these hormones that can also have an effect on humans. And in the 1940s and 50s, the sort of the biggest source of research and also of the hormones themselves in the world was Mexico. And that's what led to the contraceptive pill. One of the things I rather like about that plant is the fact that these fantastic heart-shaped leaves are sort of almost symbolic, really, of a drug that has obviously affected the love lives of millions and millions of people.
Tell us then about the history of beer.
Well, beer was, you know, the first beer recipe that we know of using barley was from the Sumerian times, about 4,000 years ago or so. There's a wonderful cuneiform tablet that has the world's first beer recipe on it. And barley is particularly good for beer because it contains just the right amount of carbohydrates, but also these special enzymes in there that gradually sort of break down the sugars and turn it into tasty stuff that we can ferment.
Another plant you focus on is dandelions.
Well, dandelions are regarded by us as weeds, but during the Second World War, when supplies of rubber from the Far East got interrupted, people looked to the latex from dandelions to see whether there was rubber in it, and there is. Now, latex in dandelions and in every other plant species is really there as the plant's way of defending itself against insect attack. But dandelion roots have quite a lot of latex in them, and this latex can be kind of boiled up and extracted. And in the Second World War, there were large fields in Eastern Europe and in the United States experimentally growing dandelion for rubber. And just recently, there's been quite a big EU project, another one in the US, to use dandelions for this, because it means that there's then less pressure on tropical forests. And the first dandelion-based rubber tyres are actually on the market now.
The section on tomatoes is fascinating.
Look, the tomato is a really kind of amazing plant, really, because it's pollinated. I mean, the way that plants work is that in order to have baby plants, they need to get their pollen from one flower to another flower, and they commandeer insects often to do their bidding. And tomato plants get bumblebees to come along and get their pollen and take it to another flower. And the bumblebee has to raise its wing beat to a middle C in order to vibrate the flower at just the right resonant frequency to make the pollen come out onto the bee. And people who breed tomato plants, farmers, have to keep resident hives of bumblebees inside their glass houses. And if that isn't amazing enough, the tomato fruit also appear to be affected by sound. Now, I'm not quite sure how scientists in Korea discovered this, but it turns out that you can delay the ripening of tomatoes by up to a week by playing a high C quite loud to the fruit. And so you've got these green tomatoes and you can delay their ripening by a week, which is a big deal because, if you're a farmer, you don't want to sort of have all your tomatoes reaching the market at exactly the same moment. And of course, the tomato originally came from Mexico and arrived in Europe via the Spanish conquistadors. And it was regarded with huge suspicion in Northern Europe, especially in Britain, where Gerard, in his Herbal in 1597, wrote that, this is really something to be avoided. And because it's related to other Solanum species, which include deadly nightshade and nasty things like that, and actually the mandrake, there was this huge suspicion. And even though he knew that the Italians and the Spanish were really enjoying tomatoes and eating them for supper, he knew that, and yet he still said, oh, this is something to be avoided, that sort of foreign muck. And it kept back the market for about 200 years in Britain.
Jonathan, you're connected to many universities, and at one point you were visiting industrial professor in the Graduate School of Education at Bristol University, specialising in science misconceptions.
Very interestingly, there are a lot of complete misconceptions that people have about the way the world works, which seem like common sense. And they seem like common sense because they're part of the model of the world that we make when we're just sort of 2 or 3 years old. So if you ask someone, why is it hotter in summer than in winter? They'll all say, oh, because we must be closer to the sun, because you learn that, you get closer to something's hot that's hot and you burn yourself. But we're obviously not closer to the sun in summer, because otherwise, how would Australians have winter at the same time? And, would we all be rushing to the sun at night and back again or something? If you ask people, a little seed weighs next to nothing, but a tree or a big bag of charcoal weighs a lot. Where did all the stuff come from? And people will say, well, it comes out of the ground. And you think, well, is that true? I mean, do you have trucks driving around where you are, sort of filling in all the earth that the trees have somehow dragged out of the ground? If you have a pot plant at home, how often do you have to top up the soil? Never. The stuff does not come out of the soil. It comes out of the air. Carbon dioxide from the air is the trick. My sort of mission is to help people understand and care for plants, because all human life depends on plants and their environments. And So in my own small way, that's my contribution, I think, to COP26. And if there's one thing that I would want people to understand, I suppose it is that, you know, what plants do for a living is that they take water through their roots and carbon dioxide from the air through their leaves, which is surprisingly heavy stuff. And those are the two things, basically, there's hardly anything else in plants. It's mainly those two things that go to make up the heavy stuff that you can kick and so on. So this is why planting lots of things, especially big heavy things like trees, and not chopping them down in the first place is so important in terms of climate change, because climate change is driven by carbon dioxide in the air. And the more we can take out using plants, trees especially, the better.
And your event is on Wednesday, the 2nd of June.
That's right, at 2 o'clock.
And people can book for that online. Jonathan Drury, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Now, festival goers are encouraged to share their own creative responses to the climate crisis via the new Right for Change project. And you can find all the details on the Hay website. We turn now to someone who's done just that, exploring in fiction the collision between a small African village and an American oil company. Imbola Mbui is the author of the New York Times bestseller Behold the Dreamers, which won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction and was an Oprah's Book Club selection. The novel's been translated into 11 languages, adapted into an opera and a stage play, and optioned for a miniseries. Imbola, your new book is How Beautiful We Were, and it's set in a fictional African village. Tell us about the place.
Yes, so the novel is set in a fictional African village named Kosawa. This is a village in which an American oil company had discovered oil many years before the story starts. And in the process of drilling for oil, the village had become very much contaminated. So when the story starts, the rivers in the village are covered with toxic oil. The pipelines are spilling, the oil is very dirty, and the villagers are very unhappy because the children in the village are getting sick and dying from all the pollution. So one day the villagers decide to fight back against this American oil company to put an end to all the environmental degradation.
And tell us about your main protagonist, the girl who grows up to be a revolutionary.
Yes, her name is Tula, and she is one of the children growing up in this village that has been very much polluted. So as a child, she sees her friends dying around her, and her father starts this attempt to fight against the oil company and also get the government to do something. But her father's attempts are not successful. So as Tula grows up, she gets an education. She actually travels to America to get an education, and she returns back to her village to bring this oil company to justice.
Mm. And that, I mean, pretty much follows your own path, because you grew up in Cameroon and then went to America.
I did, yes. I came here around the same age as Tula. I came to America at 17 to go to college. The difference between me and Tula is that Tula came to America and she got involved in movements and she learned a lot about fighting back. And I mostly spent my college days hanging out with my friends in my dormitory and eating in the dining hall. So I did not grow up to become a revolutionary.
But in terms of what is happening, particularly in that part of Africa with large industrial projects, I mean, is this something that you have seen? Has it affected your own home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I did not grow up in a place like Kosawa that had environmental degradation, but I did grow up in a town that had an oil refinery. So at a young age, I was aware of the politics of oil. I was aware of how much the people on whose land the oil was found did not benefit from it as much as the government or the foreign corporations. The other thing that happened is that when I was growing up in Cameroon, a very famous environmentalist named Ken Saro-Wiwa was executed in Nigeria for taking a stand against an oil company. And that very much affected me. I was very upset about the fact that somebody basically stood up to ask for very basic human rights for his people, and he was murdered. And so that awareness of oil and what happened to Saro-Wiwa and coming to America and seeing a lot of social justice movements certainly helped shape this novel.
Mm. And I mean, it's not just about the environmental degradation. It's also has echoes of colonialism in it.
Yeah, well, and that is the thing, is that, you know, back when I was growing up in Cameroon, we were talking a lot about colonialism because it was a post-colonial world. But I came to realize that colonialism has come and gone, at least in the form that was there before independence. But now we have corporate imperialism, right? And corporate imperialism is no different from colonialism. It is all the same, similar tools that are used to deprive people of their right to live comfortably in their own environment.
Mm. So Greta Thunberg, of course, is the kind of worldwide youth face of the climate change movement. But there are so many people doing exactly the same thing, like Tula, in Africa, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are. And all over the world, Tula was inspired not only by events in Africa, but events that are happening in Ecuador, events happening in America. And there are women like Tula all over the world who are trying to push back against what corporations or governments are doing in their communities. And many of them have lost their lives, especially in South America. And what most people don't know is that environmentalists have been murdered all over the world, in Africa, in South America, in Asia, to stand up against the corporation and demand that they allow you to live comfortably in your own environment is almost a dangerous thing to do these days. So what happened to Sarah Wiwa continues to happen to people all over the world today.
And it's about greed, really, isn't it?
It is about greed also. It is about, it's also about power, right? It's about, you know, people who believe that they have the power to take what is not theirs. This oil company comes to this village and says, we're going to take your land and we don't care what happens to your land in the process. But then the villagers also discover that they also have a power. Like, it might seem as if the villagers are powerless, right? When the story starts, the villagers are asking this oil company to leave them alone and they're not doing anything. But then the villagers realize that we can stand against them because we love our land. We are connected to our ancestry. And that gives them a sort of power that they didn't know that they have to fight against this oil company. Of course, the fight takes many, many years and there are losses on both sides. But what I wanted to explore was what happens when people realize that they are indeed powerful and can also take a stand.
Mm. So would you say this book is a call to action?
Well, it is a work of fiction, which anybody can interpret the way they want to interpret. I don't write with any sort of agenda. I write from a place of curiosity. I write from a place of questions. I grew up being very much fascinated by people who take a stand against injustice. And again, I didn't grow up to become like any of those people, but I think what I wanted to do in this book, more than anything else, more than a call to action, was to pay homage, to sing a sort of love song to people who dare to stand up for what is true and just.
Mbola, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Regina.
Mbola Mbue's book, How Beautiful We Were, is out now, and she will be in conversation with Diane Cook, who's the author of The New Wilderness, on Thursday, the 3rd of June at 8 p.m. And you can find out more about the Hay on Earth series at the Hay Festival website. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, produced by Nora Hull and presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.